I could throw out five or six things right now, and mm-hmm. that landscape would be completely different in 13 months.
Right? Okay.
So just a little over a year, I think it would be different. But I think the ones that are more likely to stay over time, people love fraud. It's one of the staples of my career is, you know, how much fraud goes on.
This is the Future of Cyber Risk podcast, brought to you by Team Cymru. I'm your host, David Monnier, fellow at Team Cymru. Let's jump right into today's episode.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for listening to another episode of the Future of Cyber Risk podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Chris Copeland, Associate Professor and Director of the Institute of Homeland Security and Cybercrime at Tarleton State University, and Executive Director at the Juno Initiative, a non-for-profit 501c3 charitable organization that works with law enforcement to assist in the identification and interdiction of human trafficking in North Texas. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for taking time out. So, Chris, usually what we like to start with is just a short introduction. Maybe tell us about yourself and kind of what your career looked like as you made your way to where you are.
Okay. So like many people in information security and IT in general, I started out on the help desk, right? You know, everybody kind of cuts their teeth somewhere. And I started out like many in the mid-90s on a help desk and then moved my way up through network and server admin to starting to incorporate more of security mindset. I had applied to law enforcement to federal agencies along the way. And unfortunately, due to a back injury, I was taken out of that. And so that left me going into cybersecurity from a perspective of either professionalism or through academic purposes. And then I got the opportunity to start teaching and start researching. So I took it and left IT after about 19 years. It's been an amazing transition. Been doing it now for, this will be my 14th year total. And so, yeah, I think it's been fantastic. Certainly a much different job than what I was accustomed to, an academic environment versus like a corporate environment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I came like many through a roundabout way to really understanding these materials.
So how has your transition been from being like you said, help desk, that's kind of technology role, sysadmin, technology role, executive director, no offense to executive directors of the world,
none,
not a technical role. So
yeah, not transition been? It's been difficult.
Yeah.
I won't lie or sugarcoat it in the least. There's a difference between a super technical role, like a help desk or system admin, right? To a team lead, which is even still moderately technical, but you have a small team, and I did that. To be the one-stop shop or even a researcher, you're obviously very self-driven, but there's so many more things that happen when you're at the C level. Just if you don't have a resource or a reliance on somebody to help you out, you learn the hard way. And unfortunately, that's how I'm learning at the process. I'm asking questions when I can. I've got excellent people to help me out along the way, but I'm learning so much just through trial and error, baptism of fire sort of situations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's completely different.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So tell us some about your Juno initiative. What do you guys do?
Yeah, I'm very excited about Juno. We founded in 2021, late part of 2021. So right in the middle of the pandemic. And of course, I can never say that my timing is excellent. But the idea there was that we have so much low-hanging fruit in terms of identifying human trafficking, especially in online ads. And the tools that were out there were not doing the job adequately enough for law enforcement. They're decent tools at tracking, but they're not good at identifying. So after getting some feedback from law enforcement partners I was working with in other grants and other opportunities, it was pretty easy for us to go, you know, I think we can do better. The solutions that are out there charge law enforcement. I have no issues with a company making money, but they price themselves out in a number of cases for those agencies that are not large enough. So I live in the DFW area, not large enough like Fort Worth or Dallas, right? But they're not small agencies either. They still have to run these teams or they participate in a task force and resources are slim. So we came up with a pretty simple machine learning classification algorithm that goes through and starts to look at the identifiers based on the academic literature and based on the feedback from law enforcement of what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So the idea is we reduce the amount of investigation time that they utilize, which is hundreds of hours, mm-hmm. down to we serve it to them on a silver platter. Like, here is your daily report. Mm-hmm. And that's the end goal. And we're currently in prototype mode for that.
Okay.
So that they don't have to go through, at the moment, most investigators go through manually and look at these advertisements pages and visually determine. Right. And so we're going, all right, tell me what you're looking for and let us assign a probability that this is within your wheelhouse. This is what you're looking for. And then here's all the ads for today, so that we reduce the amount of investigation hours necessary. So it helps them really finesse and target what they need to be looking at instead of filtering through all the noise.
So was the previous effort for them just entirely manual?
It's currently very manual.
Okay. So they're just scrolling through forum posts, looking for presumably people who are advertising in the area. Then they look to see, do we recognize a cell phone? Do we have a, is this an error code? Can we identify the human being?
Exactly. That is exactly what they're doing right now. They literally go to Google and type in blah, blah city escorts, and then they go through the pages manually. And I'm like, okay, we can do better than that. And,
yeah.
And here's how, I mean, not only am I a cyber expert, right? But I'm also a criminologist. I'm like, okay, you tell me what you're looking for, what these indicators are. The literature's changed a little bit, but not that much. And we can deliver this to you as a product free of charge. We're grant funded and donation funded. So we don't charge law enforcement to do this, and it frees them up because they do have limited resources. They do have limited hours of investigation time.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And obviously some people would argue it was like the inevitable use of the internet, right? But it's a huge problem. And I don't think that people in society really truly understand the role that the internet is facilitating in that. I think they largely imagine some wanting person is wanting to do these things and they're looking for customers and they go online and they imagine just the last part of the scenario. I think they really believe that there are people out looking for customers and the internet is only in that piece. And they completely are, I'll use the word ignorant, of the fact that no, the internet is actually on the front side of this as well. These people are oftentimes, you know, these Andrew Tate type of folks, right, who are out using the internet to attract people who that they then basically force into a human trafficking and go that way. And I don't think that people really realize that. I think a lot of people, particularly in the United States, they imagine that this is just prostitution. And they don't realize that oftentimes, no, this is forced human trafficking. And they just don't realize that. And I think if more folks understood that stuff, like you mentioned, applying for grants and things like that, it's a shame that that's what it takes, if you think about it, to be able to get law enforcement the help that they need to save these people, because that's quite literally what it is. I think everybody else imagines it's this victimless crime and, you know, chasing down people who are wanting to be doing this. And I don't think that people just realize that. I don't think they realize that's what the internet is being used for in that case.
Yeah. And I would agree wholeheartedly. Right. And as soon as bulletin boards from the 80s and 90s, as soon as they cropped up, material was available. Right. All the way through Usenet circles in the 90s and early 2000s, even Usenet today. So content has always been, and the willingness to produce content has always been there. And I think people conflate prostitution with human trafficking. One's a dark crime. When I say dark crime, what I mean is it's underreported. And the other is consenting adult doing what they want. If you're truly a consenting adult and doing what you want with your body and your life, that's not who we're after. I flipped through a number of advertisements for people who are doing what they want as a consenting adult. However, they want to justify it. That's not who we're after. We're after the ones who have been forced into this lifestyle, who have been sold into this lifestyle, just to say, to put it bluntly. And that's who law enforcement's after too. I mean, they have prostitution, at least in the state of Texas, in most states, I think in the United States, it's still a crime, right? Solicitation of it. But that's not our focus. I gloss right over those ads and look for the cherries, that low-hanging fruit in minutia of trying to get through all the news.
What percentage of the overall forum posts that you look at, what percentage of them fall into that category? I think that would be an interesting statistic for people to know as well, so that they realize.
It would be great to know that. I'm going to be very truthful and say that I think there's no way to know.
Okay.
Because it's such an underreported thing. And that's not only based on the type of crime that it is and the types of adjacent crimes, prostitution or solicitation being adjacent crimes. But it's also a Gnostic issue. Like, there's no real way to measure it. You break it up just the crimes, and then you break it up by gender and race. And those things become dramatically more difficult to categorize and to count. The only thing as criminologists we can ever really rely on are police reports. As a police department reports their crimes annually or quarterly, or it used to be the UCR, now it's NIBRS, So now it's the National Incident-Based Response System that we have to rely on the things that are reported.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody reports on human trafficking, right? It's so underreported because all we can rely on is somebody either getting arrested for it due to investigations, or somebody in a victimization aspect coming forward and saying, I'm being trafficked. This is happening to me. Get me out.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we see some of it in the National Victimization Response Survey. And that's just another avenue that we can garner some level of what human trafficking is in the United States. But it's so underreported and so dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real way of knowing right now what those numbers are.
I see. Okay. So the name, Juno. Why the name?
Roman goddess, protector of mothers and children.
There we go.
It was very poignant. And my marketing guy came up with that. And he's exceptional at what he does, and I would have never thought of it. So that's the name we went with.
Yeah, fantastic name. So, Chris, I don't want to use the whole episode just talking about the Juno Initiative, but at Team Comer, you know, we founded the company with an ethical mission. We've started a company not to make money, but to save and improve lives, human lives. That's the mission statement of Team Comer, and it always has been. Company was started by Rabbi Rob Thomas with that as the intention. And his belief was, if we do the right things, money will come. But the right things in this case are saving people's lives, improving people's lives by ensuring that the internet is safe. And that was why when he started the company nearly 20 years ago, that was why he started the company. So when I was going through your profile and saw that, I wanted to make sure that we talk about that first before we get into what is your regular day-to-day life. So to the listeners out there, just so you know, we're not going to just be talking about human trafficking today. But it is a very serious issue. It means a great deal to Team Comer. So when I saw that Chris focused on that in his own time, I wanted to make sure we led the episode with those details. So
well, I appreciate that a lot. Thank
absolutely.
You very much.
Yeah, it's our job, I think, as a part of our society to, you know, boost up others who are doing good stuff. So thank you so much for joining us to tell us about it. Before we move into kind of talking to your role in particular around cybersecurity and homeland security, tell us, is there a domain? Is there a URL? Can people help the Juno Initiative? How can folks follow up with the Juno Initiative?
Absolutely. It's the JunoInitiative.org. You can find us on LinkedIn. I believe we still find us on Facebook. Twitter banned us. I don't know why, but we're available on those two platforms, and the JunoInitiative.org is running always. So if you want to help donate, if you have data that you want us to look at, by all means, come and take a look. Of course, I'm always happy to take the money. It will get to good use, but if you want to know more, reach out to us. I'm happy to work on those initiatives with people.
Awesome. And if you are law enforcement working in the DFW area, North Texas area, definitely do reach out to them. Sounds like they have great resources to help you in your investigations. So, Chris, let's talk homeland security and cybersecurity at the university. So what does your day-to-day look like as director? And tell us some about your program and the curriculum.
Okay. So I know you already know, former academic yourself, my day-to-day is a lot of paperwork. There's quite a bit of teaching, lots of grading. And fortunately, I came from a family full of teachers. So those things aren't necessarily out of my wheelhouse. But there's also a lot of research that goes on. A lot of, you know, we spend most of my day-to-day doing data manipulations and R. So it's a mixed bag. Obviously, you serve on committees and things like that. But for the most part, I focus in on my teaching and research and then publish as necessary or as I'm required to. And yeah, it's enough to keep a person more than busy. It's the busiest job I've ever had. And I come from an IT field where 60 hours a week plus call rotation was not unheard of, right? And I'm still putting in more hours as a professor than I ever did in IT.
No, I
So yeah, it's busy keeping students apprised, injecting new material. You know, obviously my classes are cybersecurity related, cybercrime related, and so they're constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping up to date with the curriculum is always a challenge.
And then as you had mentioned, most of your students were law enforcement. In that role, what are some of the misconceptions that these students bring? Because in your case, they're all professionals or mostly professionals, right? So they're not like a college kid, quote unquote. You know, they're a person who is out working in the workforce and then learning cybersecurity to apply it patiently. That presumably comes with a bunch of baggage, pre-assumed realities about cybersecurity, right?
Yes.
What are some of those misconceptions that your students, and then presumably, I would imagine practitioners out there in the world, what are some of those things that people get wrong about cybersecurity?
So the list is huge in terms of misconceptions, but the ones I focus in on, or the ones I get most, I'd say at the undergraduate level, cybersecurity is the anti-hacker, the penetration tester. The people who are out there, you know, my undergrads, they may or may not be law enforcement. Sometimes I get non-traditional students and, you know, they're already working and they're coming back to finish their bachelor's degree. And those are my undergrads. But they think of cybersecurity as finding the guy that's on a laptop with the ski mask on in the nightlight. The standard photo, you can Google the word hacker and find an image and you'll find somebody wearing this. Yeah. Somebody doing that in a hoodie with a ski mask. The headlamp is probably my favorite.
Okay.
Right? Because I would type on a laptop with a headlamp. That's what I would do. So you get those visual preconceptions, or that everybody's breaking into every network, that nothing is secure. Of course, in reality, you know, you're right. Nothing is really secure, but we can make it very difficult, right? You know, what is encryption? Demystifying the demagic of what cybersecurity is and isn't, and how cybercrime fits into that is another aspect of it. Most of the time, undergrads only have a perception of what they see on Criminal Minds or NCIS or any of the television shows. And they come to you with those preconceptions as, that's what I want to do. And I was like, all right, well, that's great. I'm glad you want to do that. Let's go through what that means. Let's kind of bust out what those things, those kind of preconceptions happen all the time at undergrad. And I think every field has those. At the master's level, which is where I spend most of my time, the students are normally non-traditional students. So they're not coming in straight out of undergrad. They've come back to school. They are professionals. They've got, in some cases, years or even decades of experience. And if I'm really lucky, they have a cyber team. They have a cyber response team, or they have a cyber crimes team. In one case, I got very lucky one year and got to teach an assistant special agent in charge of the FBI. That was fantastic. And they have a whole unit for cybercrime and cybersecurity. I'm like, great. This is going to allow you to talk to them better, right? But even then, some of those undergraduate level misconceptions carry over, right? Even for the people who have a monochrome of training, what does it mean to harden the system? What does it mean to harden a target? You know, well, they know what that means from counterterrorism, right? They know what that means from a public safety perspective. The translation into a virtual or information system-based realm was much more difficult for them to conceptualize. And so kind of break those tendencies down. And then I find that use cases help really break those molds. What is a Bitcoin scam? All right, how does Bitcoin work? They know of Bitcoin, but they don't know anything about cryptocurrencies. So just taking one little tackle at a time in the 14 weeks that I get them and try to break those down. It depends. The misconceptions change from year to year. So 12 years ago, cryptocurrency scams weren't an issue. Today they are. Business email compromise wasn't an issue 15 years ago. Today it's one of the leading scams. Ransomware, oh my gosh, the explosion of ransomware in the scene has changed how and what curriculum I develop each semester. So I would say the misconceptions change, but there's those core ones that it's just a lack of knowledge that comes with it.
Sure. So the Institute is split, right? So you have Homeland Security and cybercrime, right? Two different balls there, critical infrastructure, those types of things, right? Versus cybercrime, right? Which could be any number of things. How does the curriculum split the two? Are students kind of getting a little bit of both of those things when they go through in pursuit of a degree through the program? Or do they split? Are they like a critical infrastructure person versus an investigator? What's that kind of look like?
So I would be the first to argue that on a Venn diagram, you one circle, that the overlap has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I'm not even going to say the curriculum splits anymore. You really can't talk about Homeland Security without talking about the gigantic component of cybersecurity, or even the subcomponent of cybercrime in the room. There isn't a single area of critical infrastructure that doesn't have a cyber component. There isn't a single part of the defense intelligence slash wartime making industry or weapons manufacturers or defense contractors that doesn't have, I mean, the DIA exists for a reason. There isn't a single aspect of intelligence tracking today that doesn't have a cyber component to it. And security, of course, hopefully built into these things at conception, right? So I would be the first to argue, at least to my colleagues, that the overlap is greatening and the distance between the two has shortened quite a bit.
Okay.
I don't see an overlap anymore. I mean, there's certain aspects to this. Yes, of course, anti-terrorism has this, but how are you tracking the communications? right? That's SIGINT, right? What kind of intelligence are we gathering on communications? That leads to things like Telegram and Signal and modern messaging and communications mm-hmm. that didn't exist 15 years ago or mm-hmm. didn't exist in the current form. So yeah, I don't think the overlap is that small anymore. And I don't think it's enough to say, yeah, they're really split. Mm-hmm. So I approach it holistically, both in the curriculum and in the research that I do. I try to approach it holistically.
Okay, awesome. And you guys, you had mentioned having a master's program as well as undergrads. Do you have an undergrad program that results in a degree related to these topics or just the master's program?
Yes. I mean, I teach in criminal justice and criminology. So we have obviously a bachelor's, we have a master's, we even have a PhD program in criminology and criminal justice at Tarleton.
Okay.
For cybersecurity, it's a sort of a mixed bag in terms of what departments teach what. So the computer science people have the degree, right? The very technical people, they have the cybersecurity degree where they get questions about encryption. They get the exam notifications on how do I go about doing this? What certifications should I get? And then information systems has a bunch of those classes where they need to kind of fill in the gaps of, okay, this is how you would apply a database to this. This is what security on a large scale data set would look like. This is cloud computing. So it's just built organically over time at the university that I'm teaching at, that I walked in as probably the only cybersecurity expert at the time in 2014, 2015. Now there are several, okay. Right? And I came in under criminal justice because of my influence on cybercrime. So I'm interested in how crimes are permitted and done on the internet. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the avenue and vector that you came in. But yeah, there are degree programs available for all three. And then each one has their own overlap to cybersecurity and or cyber crimes.
Awesome. So tell us some about what are the essential skills that folks need to succeed in your program. Obviously, this would be industry-wide, right? It's not unique to the curriculum you're doing. But in this example, let's say for your curriculum, what are some of the skills that you think are essential for folks to have or develop in order to succeed in this space?
Okay. So there's two parts to that question, I think. The first is, are they technical to begin with? And if not, where are they at? Mm-hmm. Knowing my audience is probably the biggest advantage I have. And that's my audience is people who are, they've grown up in a technical age, right? These are people who have grown up now. Gen Z is well into their undergraduates. And understanding their level of technological capability is probably the greatest strength you have as an instructor. I teach my courses from a non-technical aspect. If I've got a police officer who wants to promote and needs his bachelor's degree or her bachelor's degree, what skills do they need? Do they need the technical skills or do they need a framework of skills from which to draw from and the technology just changes? If there's something specific, like every semester, I teach them all how to find their IP address and what an IP address is, right? And how to do a DNS lookup. Some basic things that can help them in investigations. That's not the same thing I would ask of a computer science student, right? Or a student in information systems. Mm-hmm. When I find students in those classes, they want something more challenging. I provide that to them. Hey, I want you to find this site on the dark web. It's a site I've done, right? Mm-hmm. Go to it, find it. What's the PGP key? Can you find a PGP key in this mess of HTML? Can you find an open port on this server that I'm running? Mm-hmm. Those more technical skills are reserved for more technical students. The non-technical students, I really try to give them a framework. Hey, oh yeah, I remember that from class. Mm-hmm. Here's how I would go about doing that. Metadata was a huge one, like understanding what metadata was and then how to obtain it. Sure. I've had students come back and say, hey, by the way, I'm now the photographer for such and such a police department on crime scenes.
Sure.
Learning about metadata was fantastic. I use it every day.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really cool. Thank you. I appreciate that. So yeah, it just depends on the student, I would say, and the framework or technical skills I would offer. If you have technical skills, keep them going. Keep them going as long as you can. Mm-hmm. If you don't have technical skills, learn how to learn abstractly. Take into something and say, okay, how could I apply variations on this topic? And those critical thinking skills, I think, are probably the most important.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned metadata. Huge value in that. You know, a lot of people don't realize document metadata, but for folks out there, if they weren't aware, document metadata is how the BTK serial killer was caught. He used a computer at the church, I believe, to taunt, I think, law enforcement. He was sending disks or something. He was sending documents to them, and they went through the metadata and discovered where the machine was that it was made from. I want to say he was from Kansas somewhere, is where he had done all these crimes. But law enforcement there, they had their break because of document metadata. And this guy was a better criminal than he was a technologist because he had no idea, luckily.
The first time I won't take too much time on this, but the first time I taught about metadata was when I think iPhone hit 4 or 5. I was trying to give an example, and I stood in front of a class of about 25 undergrads, and they simply just weren't getting it. And I could just see in their eyes, you might as well be speaking Greek or Latin because they're not getting it. So I was like, all right, tell you what, I grab my phone. So I'm going to take a picture of everybody right here in the corner of this room. The corner of the room was in the corner of the building. It was easy to find. I mean, it's corner of a corner. Took the photo and then literally just plugged my iPhone into the screen in the front of the room, pulled the photo up, showed them the metadata. Like, this is what this means. This is what this means. Oh, here's the longitude and latitude. Plugged it into Google Maps right there and then, and it was accurate within 3 feet. It showed me in the corner of the room of the corner of the building.
Sure.
And then they got it. And I was like, and thanks to modern day social media, I know what all of your bathrooms look like.
Right.
And you could just see the wash over. And we talked about the fact that once something's out on the internet, it never goes away. And then the dawn of realization washed over the classes. Oh no. I was like, yes, I can see it. I won't say names, but I can see it on all of your faces. What just dawned on all of you that your metadata, including your latitude and longitude, is out there somewhere.
That's right.
And then you could just, over the next day or two, I got so many emails. Well, how do I turn off my location tracking?
It's like, sure.
This is how you do that. And we went through it as a class, but yeah, metadata is a super strong tool, especially for investigations.
Yeah, huge, huge. And I mean, in the Ukraine situation years back, well, I guess it's been, 14 years ago now, something like that, when Crimea situation kicked off, there were people who used the photos, the EXIF data, which is the metadata found in photographs for our listeners. They used EXIF data to validate that these soldiers that were supposedly on the other side of the world, that was the claim from the Russian Defense Ministry, they showed that these people were all over Crimea because they were posting their pictures and then people were downloading them off VK. And like you said, looking at the lat long and said, no, you're right here in this village in the Donbass, which is very powerful. Hard to fake that. Yeah.
I get within 3 meters in some cases and 3 feet within others. So 1 to 3 meters at the time was its accuracy level. I'm sure it's even more accurate now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Chris, you are responsible for maintaining course material, right? And obviously there is one set of drivers for that, and that's kind of the news cycle, right? Like things that are happening and whatnot. But the rest of what I would assume drives you is what you perceive to be the next big thing, you know, a thing that you want to make sure that your students are aware of, right? And those effectively are the challenges of the future, right? You're looking to equip these folks. So from your perspective, what do you think are the challenges that folks will see, that we'll see in particular around cybercrime for the next, say, you know, 5-10 years?
Wow. So I think the landscape, I could throw out 5 or 6 things right now. That landscape would be completely different in 13 months.
Right? Okay.
So just a little over a year, I think it would be different. But I think the ones that are more likely to stay over time, people love fraud. It's one of the staples of my career is how much fraud goes on. Right. So you may see the way fraud is instigated change. But like right now, again, cryptocurrency fraud is huge. There's a number of really big cases, FTX being one of the biggest, right? Where it's borderline Ponzi scheme kind of fraud.
That's very nice of you to phrase it that way. I would just call it Ponzi scheme.
Well, you know, ultimately it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a very complex Ponzi scheme. It's nothing like I would say Bernie Madoff did or.
Right.
But
it's in the family.
Yeah, it's certainly in the family of fraud, right? And even Ponzi schemes. But you see on a micro level too, all the little cryptocurrencies that pop up and pump and dump. It's the same thing as a securities exchange fraud. So now where penny stocks used to be, I mean, don't get me wrong, still is a place to go to get defrauded. I mean, if you want to go lose money very quickly, go to penny stocks. You'll get pumped and dumped pretty quickly. But now it's crypto. And it's the wild, wild west of crypto, mostly because there's very little regulation. There's tons of regulation when it comes to securities, with very little regulation in terms of various cryptocurrencies. And I think you could see that. You know, Coinbase got hacked, and so now all their wallets are up and out there. Yeah, I think there's very few cryptocurrencies that exist that are even moderately secure, and yet there are billions upon billions of dollars, US dollars, locked into them. So I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I think we're just now seeing the tip of the iceberg on that. In terms of, you're always going to see data breaches. I don't think that's going to go away. I think the scope of data breaches in terms of the number of millions of people, and I always say, the number of people who are affected by a data breach. What I mean is the millions of people who are affected by a data breach, because every data breach is X number of million people. I think Yahoo still has the record of 1.5 billion in a single data breach, but I think that will still happen, but the scope is going to be more rare as companies develop or at least implement even current standards into their processes and workflows. So those two aren't going away. I think we've only really just seen the birth of ransomware as a whole. I would argue very quickly that ransomware is going to be, I mean, it already is a bad thing. It's already been around for years. There are incident response teams available. Tarleton's part of the A&M system. A&M has an excellent response team for ransomwares for municipal governments and emergency response agencies. But it's not enough. And the response is always so much slower than the proliferation of the ransomware of the day. Right, so that's not going to go anywhere. I think those are probably the ones that are, there will be little things that come and go. Little phases or a repeat of something that comes in and out of a cycle. But I think those three are probably going to be the largest ones to stick around.
Okay. You mentioned the crypto scams. It's funny to me that people buy into those things without knowing anything about them, right? And I always thought in particular, so blockchain as a concept, great idea. I get it. But then as it started to get applied in various currency formats, I knew at the time when I very first heard about it, I knew that this seems ripe for at being exploited. People are going to exploit the fact that nobody knows anything about these, right? And one of the things, so I was flying to Europe one time and there was a guy sitting next to me, was very young. He looked like maybe 21, 22. He's wearing like a really nice Rolex. He's got all these, you know, all this nice stuff. And he was flying to Europe. And the guy asked me if he could borrow my phone charger. He saw that I had my phone charger plugged in and had unplugged it and was getting ready to put it away. And he said, hey, could I borrow your phone charger until we land? And I was like, sure. Anyway, we started talking. This guy was like, thanks so much, blah, blah, blah. Hey, what do you do? You know, what have you? And I explained to him that, you know, well, I work in cyber, specifically threat intelligence, doing attribution, you know, things like that. And anyway, the guy said, you know, hey, well, what do you know about cryptocurrencies? And I explained, well, quite a bit. And he said, well, to me, that's the future. He said, all you need to do is come up with a new crypto coin and you make all this money. And I didn't understand what he was saying. And basically, he proceeded to explain to me that he had made, I want to say three or four of these odd coins, like Rando coin, not even a coin you've ever heard of, right? And he had made something like $370,000, $380,000, he said. It was a huge amount of money from people who were buying his coin. And he said he didn't have to advertise them really. He didn't do any of that. He put his coin on an exchange, said it was, I want to say they called it like an initial coin offering or something like that. ICO, yeah, like it was a completely legitimate stock. And he said the first one that he did, he didn't really figure out how to convince people. So like the paragraph that described what the coin was and what the intention was, he didn't make that much money. But by the second one, he figured it out and he made like $100,000+ on his first try and got better at it by his third try. And that this guy was out with no other skills, just this fraud skill that he figured out that people don't know anything about this. They want to get rich so you can defraud them just by writing some grandiose description of your coin. People will want to buy it. And it was the craziest thing I had seen. Well, we landed, I want to say it was into Frankfurt, and they have like an arrivals lounge. And the guy ended up showing me his laptop and stuff. Like to him, it was entertainment. Like, it was entertaining to him to see that he was just making money, doing nothing, literally nothing, you know? And it blew his mind. And after I saw that, it really blew my mind. And I got to be honest with you, I have distrusted everything cryptocurrency since then. Ever since then, because I was skeptical to begin with, right? Like Bitcoin, when I think of Bitcoin, and no offense to all the Bitcoin champions out there, I'm sure folks will be, you know, blowing up my inbox later telling me how wrong I am. But for the most part, 99% of the world doesn't really need a currency that's so portable like that. And that the people who do need those currencies who are portable like that are typically criminals. And that's why they need this portable currency that they can try to move around, right? And I was convinced of that when I first heard of crypto. Like, I had this why. Like, what do we need this for? What does it solve, right? The purpose of currency, right, is to facilitate transaction. That's what it's for, right? And we have all these other currencies that already, we have monies and currencies that facilitate all this already. So why did we need a new one? It was very interesting to me. But after I met that guy, I won't say I looked down on crypto coin, by the way. That's not what I mean. I just don't see its utility, right? I thought it would be a fad. But then after seeing that, I'm convinced that most of the people tied up in crypto are this kind of thing, that they're either like chasing after what's new and they don't understand how financial investments work, or they're on the other end of the spectrum and they're some kind of person who is just like, let's rip these, you know, these suckers off.
I've only ever found one use case.
Okay.
That made sense. And it's the caveat of option two in your scale of only criminals use it, right? Mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to be part of NIJ, National Institute of Justice grant here at Tarleton, and we had to look at online dark web markets.
Mm-hmm.
And in those markets, they accepted two forms of payment. They accepted Bitcoin and they accepted another one called Monero.
Mm-hmm.
Monero is one of the few that is very difficult to try out, sitting here telling, hey, if you're a criminal, you should use Monero. No, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah, it's not news, but it uses the Onion protocol to obfuscate its ledger, its mm-hmm. network ledger. And two markets that we were monitoring, well, this was for, you know, trying to see who sells what. We were trying to get a lay of the market trends, right? We weren't trying to find who's selling the drugs. Like, I don't really care who's selling the drug. But it was interesting to watch as these markets only allowed certain payments of certain coins that would fit into their operational security parameters. So if you use Bitcoin, you are less favorable because the ledger can be tracked, right? Mm-hmm. They don't want it coming back to the market wallet. They don't want it coming back to the vendor's wallet. So Monero was one of the few use cases where I went, okay, they're choosing the cryptocurrency for online transactions based on their operational security. And so that was a whole new avenue for me. I'd never thought about, I'm very much like you. I put $300 into crypto to see how the exchanges work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Knowing full well that I'm probably going to lose $300. And I thought, well, this is my entertainment and this is my research intelligence gathering. You know, I wanted to figure out how Coinbase worked. I wanted to see how, I think it was Gate.io, how they work, how Webull kind of worked on some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, I was like, it's not great, but I can lose $300 for the amount of knowledge I will gain. And of course, I did all of it, like none of it's left. But yes. I very much like you. What was my time worth versus what my money was worth?
Right.
But yeah, in terms of a use case, I had never seen a use case that really benefited, I think, normal everyday transactions.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm starting to see cryptocurrencies accepted in prostitution online. Now I'm starting to see cryptocurrencies accepted. Alibaba, you know, AliExpress accepts cryptocurrency now. You can send Bitcoin to China. I have issues with that. I don't know, like, you know, how do you know it's really going to the right place? How do you know it's when I have the protection of a credit card? Those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I agree with you fully on crypto, but it's been a wild ride so far.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, yeah, in terms of news, right? That's one of the things that I routinely pull up that changes every semester that I teach.
Sure. Yeah. Monero is probably responsible for millions of dollars, for lack of a better word, let's call it stolen electricity. People compromise websites and instead of taking the data, they inject Monero miners. And in the background, there's a process running on people's servers and all their data is there and everything. And they don't think anything of it. But little do they know, their CPU is pegged on their websites because it's doing all this Monero mining. I've seen that hundreds of times. It's really remarkable. So to our listeners out there, if you run a hosting company or know someone who runs a hosting company or whatever, keep an eye out for connections into OnionRouter network because
watch that utilization.
Absolutely, because you will see if you have a host that's talking a lot there and the PDUs on that rack are pegged, that's why. So anyway, Chris, being mindful of our time, we'll go ahead and move to closing thoughts. Any advice that you have for folks out there that are either pursuing an academic path or just looking to get into the industry as a whole? What's three pieces of advice that you might have for them?
Three pieces of advice. One, read. Lots of reading. I will be the first to say that this industry is less about penetration testing and less about anti-hacking efforts as it is more about auditing and compliance, true risk management, right? If you want a job in the field, you need to be looking to risk management, understand NIST, understand GDPR, understand PCI DSS compliance, those kind of things, the things that will land you gainful employment. Mm-hmm. Two, it's an ever-changing field. Be ready for your technical skills to go out of date. Just know it's going to happen. So if you're technical and you want to stay technical, you have a career ahead of you. Mm-hmm. But it's a daunting thing to keep those technical skills up. And three, I would say, like this podcast, like what I do in the community, be willing to give back. Explain yourself to others. I call it my little old ladies clubs. I go out to like the Lions Club of my local city or a retirement community, and I explain cybersecurity for a bunch of senior citizens who don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. But it gets them thinking, it gets them moving. And I think that level of giving back to the community is absolutely critical for anybody in the field, because not only does it get your name out there, right? Or it gets your company out there, but you will be fielding questions you had not thought of, mm-hmm. right? By a bunch of people who have nothing but a bunch of grandchildren and current internet devices. Mm-hmm. They were going to come up with questions that you haven't thought of yet. Simple questions. So I would say those are my three things that I live by, that I utilize to bring new students and new people into the field. And the fourth might be, make sure you have a portfolio. A portfolio, like I use GitHub for students to say, you know, build a GitHub portfolio, do your audits or do your compliance testing, put them up there as record of your experience, mm-hmm. especially for new students in the field. Mm-hmm. They're looking for their first time job out of college. They've reinvented themselves as an adult. Having that portfolio is going to be useful.
Sure. Absolutely. That's kind of the proof is in the pudding stage, right? It's always good to have that. Yeah, absolutely agreed. You know, you mentioned in that first part, talking about risk management, one of the things that I think a lot of folks that I have discovered, what they tend to lose sight of is that it's risk management, not risk eradication or risk avoidance. You need the risk. That's why you're in business. That's why you're doing the thing that you're doing. And that's why people put money into it, is because there is a risk, because there is also a reward. And a lot of people see security as this idea that they're trying to completely eradicate and remove risk. But I hate to break it to everybody. If you remove risk entirely, there's a good chance that you're removing the value of what you're doing. So business should be risky. That's usually what makes it valuable.
Especially,
and successful, in particular, a new business. So for folks out there, you need to look at things in the lens of what is my appetite for risk and how do I manage that risk? But if your appetite for risk is zero and you're out to eradicate risk, be very cautious, because it's a good chance you're going to eliminate the very things that are valuable to everybody else and makes your business valuable and successful. So, but anytime I hear people say that.
It's the old CIA triad, right? The three things you can get is confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And the joke has always been, and I know most people know this, but if you're new to the field or you're a new CISO or your new C-suite, the joke has always been pick two and then wait. Right? You can have confidentiality and integrity, but your availability is going to be nil or significantly impacted. You can have availability and integrity, but there's little confidentiality. So that risk, it's never risk deletion. It's never risk eradication. At best, on your best days, it'll be risk mitigation.
That's right.
Like, you know, there's a reason continuance of operations plans exists, right? And it's not that you avoided the risk. It's that you managed to survive it.
That's right.
You're mitigating the risk. I had to do coup plans for Hurricane Ike when Ike hit Texas a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, you know, it's not going to hit us. I was like, you're right. It may not hit us, but our backbone providers in Houston, I can guarantee it's going to hit them.
It's going to hit them. Yeah.
And if we were to lose internet for being an online business, if we're going to hit to internet, what's our backup plan? Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, we didn't think about that. Well, sure. I know. So let's think about it now, right? I sure enough, we got so much rain, it damaged the facility and knocked out power for 3 days. We had laptops ready to go. Laptops and cellular provider ready to go. Business was not interrupted.
Sure.
So at best, risk mitigation. At worst, risk survival.
Sure.
Right? So yeah, I think you're absolutely right in that regard.
Sure. And in that, I would point out, you took on the risk of a bunch of additional electronics in your business model. A bunch of laptops, a bunch of cell phones, a new supplier, and a bunch of additional hardware is a new risk of its own. So you
yes, you're absolutely correct.
You offset one risk, took on a new risk, because again, I would say if it's risky, it's probably worth doing business around.
But and it was.
You know, exactly. Yep. And if it's not, there's probably a good chance it's not what you should be doing anyway, because probably not a lot of money in it. So, but anyway, Chris, thanks so much for joining us today. If folks want to follow your research and to see your program, and in particular, again, folks, the Juno Initiative, very, very important effort there. If folks wanted to follow that, what are some ways that folks can see what you're up to?
I would say LinkedIn is probably my way that I publish the research most often, aside from being in a journal or something like that. I almost always post to LinkedIn.
Okay.
Because a number of my students are there and a number of former students are there and a number of my colleagues are there too.
Okay.
So LinkedIn for both. Obviously, the university has its own website, tarleton.edu/criminaljustice. And you can find my mug under the faculty page. But yeah, I think those two are probably the best way to go.
Okay.
Of course, you can always reach me at either one of those ways. And there's some way I can help you or your organization. Just let me know.
Awesome. Well, thank you much for joining us today. For our listeners, we will make sure to have links for all of Chris's details and his nonprofit initiative. There'll be links in the show notes. So keep an eye out for those. And Chris, again, thank you so much for joining us. Keep up the good work. Thank you, random internet citizen, if you will. Know that what you're doing matters and to keep up the good work. If we can help you at Team Cymru, if we can help with the initiative at all, ever, please don't hesitate to let us know.
Copy that. David, this has been just an amazing pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Future of Cyber Risk podcast, brought to you by Team Cymru. For the latest episodes, please visit team-cymru.com or search Future of Cyber Risk on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks, and we'll catch you on the next episode.